This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In Washington, New York, and London, Islamabad, Riyadh, and Kabul, a future without Osama bin Laden began to unfold today, as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton noted, similar but different.
Our message to the Taliban remains the same, but today it may have even greater resonance. You cannot wait us out. You cannot defeat us, but you can make the choice to abandon al-Qaeda and participate in a peaceful political process.
NPR commentator Ted Koppel joins us as we focused on what happened in Abbottabad, on the life and death of Osama bin Laden, and what's changed between Washington and Islamabad. Stay with us. Special coverage after this report of the day's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. More details are emerging about the U.S. operation in Pakistan last night that ended with the death of al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. NPR's Rachel Martin says a small special operations team used two helicopters to raid a highly fortified compound in a city outside Islamabad.
The compound is located in Abbottabad, about 60 miles north of the Pakistani capital. It's a relatively affluent town, home to a Pakistani military training academy. For years, U.S. intelligence officials had been tracking a man they believed to be a close aide to bin Laden. Last year, they traced him to this compound, where they believed he was harboring the al-Qaeda leader and his family. President Obama authorized a team of Navy SEALs to raid the compound yesterday. Bin Laden, three other men, and a woman were killed in a firefight. The operation took less than 40 minutes. Rachel Martin, NPR News, Washington.
It is not closure, but at least it is justice. Those are the words echoed today by relatives of those killed in the September 11th terrorist attacks. One family member described feeling not happiness, but relief at news that the man behind the tragedy 10 years ago was finally dead. Today, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton tried to offer the victims' families some words of comfort.
I know that nothing can make up for the loss of the victims or fill the voids they left, but I hope their families can now find some comfort in the fact that justice has been served.
In cities across the U.S. and around the world, though, jubilation as well as mixed feelings. NPR's Paul Brown was out on the streets of Washington, D.C. this morning listening to people's reactions to the death of bin Laden, and he found three main strands of thought.
Marietta Day of Washington sums up the most common reaction.
I am so glad. Yes, it's a relief.
Her friend Edith Briggs shares the sense of relief but expresses anxiety and apprehension I hear several times.
I am very happy, but I'm also kind of on guard, because I think they are going to retaliate some kind of way.
Keith Fugley is grateful to President Obama.
I'm glad that he's continued to pursue this very diligently, and I think it's a very positive step forward.
Jamie Bell says she understands the concern about retaliation, but also says
it kind of reinstates our stance on the global level that, you know, we are strong.
People heading to work in Washington, D.C. this morning. Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. authorities say bin Laden's body was buried at sea, keeping with Islamic tradition to conduct a burial within 24 hours. Now concerns abound about possible reprisal attacks from bin Laden's followers. U.S. embassies are on a heightened state of alert. There's also heavier security at the site of the World Trade Center. This is NPR News. Chrysler has posted its first profit since bankruptcy. NPR Sonari Glinton says the Michigan-based automaker made $116 million in the first quarter of 2011.
In many ways, Chrysler is the weakest of the Detroit car companies. It was the first to show signs of financial trouble, and now it's the last to post a quarterly profit. The company revamped almost all of its cars and got a slick new ad campaign that helped spark the company's sales, which jumped 18% worldwide in the first 3 months of the year. The company says it intends to repay the Canadian and U.S. governments $7.5 billion in bailout money this year, and insiders say they want to begin trading on the New York Stock Exchange within the next 18 months. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
Libyan government troops are again bombarding Misrata, the only major city in the West in rebel hands. Witnesses report rocket fire and heavy shelling on the town in the morning, and fears are rising over rumors that Colonel Muammar Gaddafi may be preparing to use chemical weapons. Well, mob attacks on several European embassies in the Libyan capital are prompting the United Nations to pull its international staff out of Tripoli. The crowds turned violent as they gather today in the capital for the funeral of Muammar Gaddafi's son and three grandchildren. Gaddafi's relatives reportedly were killed in a NATO airstrike. The Libyan leader did not appear to be at the funeral, but one of his sons was there. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 23 points at 12,836. NASDAQ losing some ground, down slightly 1 point at 2,872. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working with states to implement the Fostering Connections Act, on the web at aecf.org.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We know now that Osama bin Laden spent his last few months not shivering in a cave in remote Waziristan, but behind the high walls of a purpose-built safe house an hour's drive from Pakistan's capital. We know that U.S. forces burst into the compound early this morning, Pakistan time, with orders to kill. We know that bin Laden died from two gunshots to the head, that U.S. forces then took his body to the aircraft carrier USS Vinson, where the corpse was washed and then quickly disposed of in the waters of the Arabian Sea. In this hour, more about the life and death of Osama bin Laden and on the future of al-Qaeda. We begin, though, with commentator Ted Koppel. He, of course, covered the events of 9/11 for ABC News and joins us now from his home in Maryland. Ted, good of you to be with us.
It's always good to be with you, Neil.
And it's been almost 10 years since this manhunt has continued. What changes now that Osama bin Laden is dead?
Well, first of all, if I may, Neil, let me stress what hasn't changed. There has been today a sense of validation, a sense of continuity. We spend so much time in this country, and particularly in recent years, focusing on the ideological differences between liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans. Let me just take a moment to point out that this represents a sense of continuity. What President Obama has completed is what President Bush began, and for all that we stress the differences, the fact of the matter is that what has happened today is a continuity of American foreign policy, that when you attack the United States of America, when you kill 3,000 innocent citizens of ours, you must expect not only that the administration in power is going to respond, but that each administration down the line is going to continue to feel that obligation.
As you look at that continuity, then, obviously there is a great deal in policy in Afghanistan that remains the same, maybe even more accelerated since President Obama took office. More U.S. forces, more drone attacks in the tribal areas of Pakistan where many believed Osama bin Laden was hiding. One thing that changes, though, is the relationship between the United States and Pakistan, which is critical to the conduct of the war in Afghanistan.
I'm not sure that it changes, Neil, because it's been pretty lousy for the last several, many months, in fact. I've had a couple of people, both Pakistanis. I happened to be at a dinner a couple of nights ago given by a Pakistani friend of mine. There were a great many senior Pakistani officials there. And the mood that that was reflected at that time was U.S.-Pakistani relations are not only not good, they are extremely bad. And if you want to look at one of the reasons why that is so, you have only to examine this house, this extraordinary million-dollar property, as it's been described in Abbottabad, which is only 35 or 50 miles from the capital of Islamabad. Here is this house with 10-foot walls around it, with barbed wire, with apparently no telephone connections, no internet connections, occupied. The people don't put their garbage out. They burn their garbage. They are literally just down the road from Pakistan's West Point, from its military academy, and yet no one, and we have heard that Osama bin Laden was apparently there at least since last August, so he's been there, for three quarters of a year now, and nobody in Pakistani intelligence or the Pakistani police or Pakistani security or the Pakistani military ever thought to inquire into who it was that was living in this house strains credulity, doesn't it?
There is also the question that the United States knew or began to think it knew last August that a highly valuable target, maybe Osama bin Laden, was in this house and never brought it up with its Pakistani allies.
Never raised it with the Pakistani allies, and indeed what we have been hearing is that while the President of the United States called President Ansari of Pakistan, he called him to let him know that the mission was underway. In other words, it was already in train. He didn't call to give him advance notice. He certainly didn't call to ask permission. And this, after all, is something that President Obama said going back a couple of years, that is an issue on which he did not intend to ask permission, that if they found Osama bin Laden in their crosshairs, they were going to pull the trigger.
Joining us now from Pakistan is Karin Brulyard, who's the correspondent for The Washington Post, and she's with us by phone from Islamabad. Thanks very much for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
And just to follow up on that last point, what are officials in Pakistan saying about what they knew and when they knew it?
Well, they're saying very little so far, which I think is confusing everyone here and raising a lot of questions here about what they knew and whether they knew anything and how much they assisted with this. Initially this morning, it took several hours after President Obama's announcement for the Pakistani government to say anything officially. Unofficially, intelligence sources were saying, yes, this was a joint operation. Yes, we knew something about it. However, hours later, when that statement was released, the Pakistani government said simply that this was a U.S. operation. They indicated that they had played no role in it, and later intelligence sources kind of backtracked on the initial statement and said, in fact, their intelligence had played some sort of part in helping this happen, but they knew nothing about it.
Is that not, in many ways, a humiliation for the government in Islamabad and President Zardari?
Yeah, I think, it's certainly embarrassing, and that's actually a word an intelligence source I spoke to used. I mean, he said, to an extent, it is embarrassing, particularly because bin Laden was captured, of course, basically next door to large military installations. At the same time, I think the Pakistani government also feels like it needs to be incredibly careful about what it says about its own role. Its alliance with the United States is incredibly unpopular in Pakistan, and of course, it's made it a target of not just al-Qaeda, but other Islamist insurgents, such as the Pakistani Taliban. And to acknowledge any sort of cooperation or role in the killing of this hugely symbolic leader could make them legitimately a target.
There was an enormous controversy earlier this year when an American CIA contractor, Mr. Davis, was apprehended after killing two Pakistani nationals on the street. How are people reacting now to an incursion by U.S. helicopters of U.S. military forces who landed deep inside Pakistan in a city and killed Osama bin Laden, three other men, and a woman they say was being used as a human shield, gathered intelligence assets, anything they could find, and flew back out?
Yeah, again, I mean, there's I think right now just a lot of questions swirling around about what the fallout is going to be. lots of people are asking, you know, was this a it looks like it was a unilateral U.S. operation, which is something that's an incredibly sensitive even notion in Pakistan, the idea. Drone strikes, which, you know, CIA drone strikes, which the Pakistani government tacitly approves but publicly denies, are you know, incredibly unpopular here among the public. But the idea, the suggestion of U.S. ground operations has always been just something that really riles the public and the military here, too. So there are a lot of people raising questions about the U.S. being able to carry out an operation, as you said, in the middle of Pakistan by itself without Pakistani consent.
Karen Bulliard, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Karen Bulliard, foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, with us on the line from Islamabad. And Ted Koppel, as we look ahead, as we look at some of those details, it is similarly telling that the United States chose not to share any of this information with Islamabad, with any intelligence assets in Islamabad, clearly for fear that if they did, word would get out.
That's exactly right. And I think we can go beyond that. There is one indicator that suggests that any notion of any kind of collaboration between the United States forces and their Pakistani friends just simply didn't happen, is that I am told that the Pakistanis actually, toward the end of the mission, as the helicopters were leaving, actually scrambled some jets. Now, that doesn't suggest that they had any advance notice whatsoever.
And as you look at the facts with Islamabad and the deteriorating relations, no small part prompted by the Davis affair earlier this year, as we mentioned, a CIA contractor who killed two men on the street. Different accounts vary as to who they were and exactly what happened, but nevertheless enormously unpopular in Pakistan, even though the president of the United States described this man as an American diplomat. Eventually, he was released after the United States paid blood money to his family. Nevertheless, as you look towards this incident in Abbottabad earlier today, Pakistan time, as you look at this incident and the promises by Pakistan in the past that Osama bin Laden was not in Pakistan, maybe in Afghanistan, maybe elsewhere, and what about Zayman al-Wahiri, the number two in al-Qaeda, the presumption is he, too, is somewhere in Pakistan.
And quite clearly, if anybody in Pakistan knows, they're not sharing it with their U.S. counterparts. I don't think there is any question. That's why at the top of the program, Neil, I laid out what I think is the sheer ludicrousness of a building, a compound that is so clearly designed to remain private. And you have to ask yourself whether someone in the Pakistani police or someone in Pakistani military or intelligence would not have asked the question, if theoretically they are looking for Osama bin Laden, they are looking for senior al-Qaeda members, you might think that a massive compound like that, in which security precautions are clearly being taken, would be something of a tip-off. They had to have known something.
NPR commentator Ted Koppel. Stay with us. We're talking about the death of Osama bin Laden. Up next, NPR's Tom Gelton and Mary Louise Kelly will walk us through his last hours and his life. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. This is special coverage from NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. President Obama today called this a good day for America. Last Friday, the president authorized the military operation that launched a team of U.S. Navy SEALs deep into Pakistan to kill the head of al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden. The secret mission was many months in the planning and followed a long trail of intelligence clues. More on that and more on the life of Osama bin Laden in just a moment. Our guest is Ted Koppel, NPR News commentator. With us here in the studio is Tom Gelton, NPR correspondent. And Tom, the president said last night the United States began to get intelligence that Osama bin Laden might be in this compound as long ago as August.
That's right, Neil. It's really a fascinating chain of intelligence calculations that culminated in this raid. And in fact, it goes even way back beyond that. You have to start with the fact that Osama bin Laden stopped using telephones and other types of electronic communication, went back to the old-fashioned way, communicating by messenger. And what the United States started doing years ago was trying to figure out who were those couriers who were delivering messages to and from bin Laden. They got some tip-offs from detainees, some of whom are at Guantanamo now, although it's not clear when the intelligence came. It could have come before they were sent to Guantanamo. And gradually they were able to put this all together. 4 years ago, they got a sense of who Osama bin Laden's most trusted courier messenger was. 2 years ago, they figured out where that courier was operating. And as you say, last August, they actually were able to identify the house where he was operating out of in
Abbottabad.
Thank you. It's been a long night. Abbottabad. And at around the same time, they started to get indications that Osama bin Laden himself might be there. So you have to look at that entire sequence of steps.
And once intelligence started looking at that compound, what did they see? Who did it belong to? Who did they think it belonged to? What did they think was going on there?
What they determined was, and by a combination, obviously we have very sophisticated satellite means to see into the compound. They identified people coming and going from it. They identified three families living there, two of which were the families of two brothers who were couriers, one in particular. The third family, just by looking at how many women, how many children, etc., conformed to their idea of how many family members Osama bin Laden himself had living with them, that they suspected was living with him. And it was on the basis of that correlation that was one more piece of evidence that this, in fact, was where Osama bin Laden was staying.
This evidence then accumulated over time, becoming firmer and firmer. We gather then a total of 5 National Security Council meetings over the past month or so as the operation started to be planned.
Just since March, that's right. And then in the last few days, of course, accelerated meetings, a number of meetings on yesterday alone as this operation was going down.
Do we know what piece of information or what group of information confirmed the belief that this was very likely Osama bin Laden?
No. That's one of those typical sources and methods questions that they just are loath to touch. The only thing that they have said specifically, as I say, was that they were able to identify sort of the makeup of a family there that conformed to what they thought Osama bin Laden's family was.
We're hearing details, as Ted mentioned earlier, no internet connection, a family that burned their garbage rather than having it removed.
Oh, yeah, there's all these indications that this was a very unique compound, a compound clearly designed to protect somebody, to hide somebody. The reference to the garbage, the very high walls, the fact there are no windows or very few windows facing to the outside, all of these, of course, added up.
And then as the operation got underway, what can you tell us about how that was conducted?
It was a special operation by special operation forces. That is usually taken to mean groups like the SEAL Team 6, which is the Navy's crack counterterrorism squad. It's kind of the Navy's, the SEAL's counterpart to Delta. The Delta Force, which has been used by the Army for similar type of operations for many years. But it's clear, I was just sitting in on a conference call with some intelligence and military officials, CIA personnel were involved in this as well. Obviously, the CIA personnel had the intelligence. They had the best intelligence. The operators were more the trigger pullers, the guys who are really experienced in firefights. So it was a joint CIA military operation.
Launched from Afghanistan, not from the consulate in or the embassy in Islamabad.
There's been some mixed reporting on that, Neil. We are convinced it came out of Afghanistan, and this is not so far from Afghanistan that it wouldn't have been impractical to fly helicopters from bases in Afghanistan in there. Over and over, U.S. authorities have said the Pakistanis did not have any idea that this was going on. And it's hard to imagine if it were coming out of a base in Pakistan that they wouldn't have had some tip-off.
And would these helicopters have been able to evade Pakistani radar by flying low, or would they have tripped it?
I asked that question to some military officers who have got a lot of experience in this, and they say a couple things. One, of course, it's a lot of the route from Afghanistan there goes through a mountainous area where they're able to fly up and down valleys. That's a good way to evade radar. More importantly, the air defense system in Pakistan has always been oriented to India, not to Afghanistan. So there really aren't a lot of radar installations in that part of Pakistan oriented to a threat coming from Afghanistan. So the combination of these very experienced special operations pilots who know how to fly at a very low altitude, and they know how to fly up and down valleys, yes, it would have been possible for them to evade radar.
Do we know if they then landed outside the walls of this compound, or did they then fly two very noisy helicopters into the compound itself?
I don't have that information. We do know, I have seen reports that which would be very typical in a special operation like this, that the operators descended by rope from into the compound. This would be a very traditional method of doing it. And you have, and you know, Neil, an interesting fact here, there was somebody in that neighborhood who was tweeting during this operation and said it was very annoying that there were these helicopters hovering in the air and keeping him from sleeping.
He also reported explosions, which could have been flashbangs, the kind of thing that are meant to stun people so that they're disoriented and maybe not able to notice people rappelling down ropes.
Yeah, well, I think you put all this together. I think we're pretty sure that the way that they got into the compound was rappelling down these ropes from the helicopters.
And obviously, you can't take a lot of heavy equipment with you in a situation like that. So, two groups of people, SEAL Team 6, we believe, and some CIA operators. What happened then?
Well, they encountered resistance. They encountered fire. One of the things that we haven't got clear answer yet is how many people actually were at that compound. We know that four adult males, including Osama bin Laden, were killed. Two of those were the two brothers whose house it was. Also, Osama bin Laden's adult son and a woman who is said to have been used as a human shield. Also, two women were injured. Now, whether additional people were captured or killed, we don't know. There have been, again, some mixed reporting on that. But we do know that there was fire on the ground level when they first went in. The bin Ladens were on the second and third floor, which were the last two floors to be cleared. It's not clear whether Osama bin Laden himself was on the second floor or on the first floor. But when they went in, and encountered Osama bin Laden, it was a face-to-face encounter. I understand that he was told to surrender. He refused. It's not clear whether he actually picked up a weapon or not. He was shot twice in the head.
We're also told earlier today that intelligence sources said the goal of the mission was to kill bin Laden, not to capture him.
Boy, you know, Neil, I think if they had captured him, what a mess that would have been. Where, you know, you're going to bring him to Guantanamo? What are you going to do? I don't have any doubt in my mind that they much preferred to have killed him than to have captured him.
So then we're told. Ted, go ahead, please.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to jump in for a second. Tom, I can envision all these guys rappelling down from the helicopters. I have a more difficult time imagining them taking bin Laden's body. He was, after all, a very big man, about 6'4", I guess. How did they get the body out? The helicopters must have landed at that point, didn't they?
Boy, you're a good reporter, Ted, asking very, very smart questions. I don't have an answer to that, but I would think they were there for 40 minutes. And once they had suppressed the fire, once they had cleared the area, once there was no more resistance, given the size of the compound, and the Defense Department, the U.S. government has put out really detailed layouts, diagrams of the compound just this morning, given the size of the compound, it would not have been hard for those helicopters helicopters to land there. So I think you're probably right in that suspicion that once it was cleared, once the resistance was over, they were able to land, and then they could load his body onto one of those helicopters.
And one of the choppers obviously had mechanical difficulties because they had to blow it up and bring in a third chopper, right?
That's right. Well, I understand that there were two other choppers in addition to the first two that came in. I think that what would you normally have in a situation like this is a couple of choppers that are sort of hanging in the area, but ready to provide fire support. So there were backup helicopters available. One of the things that one of the officials who just briefed said is that whenever you go into an operation like this, you always plan for contingencies, and the failure or the mishap of one of those helicopters would certainly have been one of the contingencies. Now, interestingly, they are being careful not to say mechanical failure. They are not saying it was hostile fire either. This is a middle of the night operation. It could have bumped into something and damaged some part of the helicopter. We don't know for sure what exactly happened.
We do know. I mean,
whatever it was, and I'll back off in just a second. I am just reminded of, it was variously described as Operation Blue Light, I think. You remember when there was that abortive attempt to rescue the hostages outside Tehran, and the helicopters went down in a sandstorm. And it was, I mean, we sometimes forget how easy it is for an operation like this to turn into a disaster.
Yes, and under very limited visibility with hostile fire, the anxiety that the Pakistanis are going to see what's coming down in their neighborhood, a half a mile from their ACE military academy. Yeah, it was clearly a very high stress operation. One other point before we end, Neil. Ted mentioned them getting Osama bin Laden's body. We have just been told that it was cleaned, washed according to Islamic ritual, and taken out to the USS Carl Vinson, which is an aircraft carrier in the North Arabian Sea. And then there was a burial at sea, including a verse that was read in Arabic when Osama bin Laden's body was then slid into the sea.
Clearly, that to avoid the creation of a shrine.
The creation of a shrine. I think another message of that was that they did not want this to turn into yet another accusation of some kind of action against Islam as a religion. And by burying even Osama bin Laden according to Islamic ritual, I think that they were suggesting a kind of a respect for Islamic tradition, Islamic practices, for Islam itself.
NPR correspondent Tom Jelton, we know it's been a long night. We thank you very much for staying with us.
My pleasure.
Let us now turn to the life of Osama bin Laden and Mary Louise Kelly, who spent the last decade covering intelligence and national security for NPR. She joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice of you to come in.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me.
And I guess Osama bin Laden first begins to show up on the radar, the son of a wealthy Saudi family, in the war against the Soviet Union and their occupation forces in Afghanistan.
Back in the 1980s. It's exactly right. And it's fascinating because when you look back at bin Laden's childhood, there is not a lot that would point you toward his ultimate fate. He grew up pampered son of a billionaire. He liked to ride horses. His friends from that time describe him as a very soft-spoken, not overly religious child. We know he went off to university as a young man in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, and he got some exposure to radical Islamist theory there. But it's exactly right. His first taste of battle came in Afghanistan in the 80s. Now, he was primarily known as the fundraiser, somebody who was helping recruit wealthy Muslims who could help back the Mujahideen. It's interesting that in that era, you know, bin Laden's interests would seem to have aligned with the U.S. They were both providing money and arms to the Mujahideen battling against the Soviet occupation. Obviously, whether or not the interests aligned, bin Laden was already no friend of the U.S., and it took another decade before he was pronouncing fatwas, proclaiming that, you know, it was the duty of all Muslims to kill Americans wherever they could find them. But it's clear that in those years, he got this taste of creating a movement, of wanting to create a jihad for Muslims, battling on behalf of Muslims, as he saw it. And it was clear, even from those early days in Afghanistan, he saw this as a global struggle. So he wanted to fight the fight in Afghanistan. He also had much wider ambitions very early on.
After the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait back in 1990. He, in fact, wanted to launch a jihad against Iraqis on behalf of all Muslims. The Saudi government took another tack and invited the United States, and as bin Laden saw it, invited in a Western occupation of the land of the two holy places.
This was a hugely important issue for bin Laden. So the Soviets lost in Afghanistan back in 1989. Bin Laden returned to Saudi Arabia. Of course, this was around the time of the first Gulf War. You mentioned Kuwait, and it was bin Laden who was very opposed to the way that the Saudi royal family was aligning itself with the U.S. in that war. He was so critical that he lost his passport. They revoked his citizenship. He was forced to flee. A couple of years later, we find bin Laden in Sudan. And this was another turning point for him, where he became, based on email, based on messages and letters that have been tracked over the years, based on communications he had, he seemed to become much more extreme. He was already in those years in Sudan in the early 90s, reaching out to extremists in Chechnya, in the Balkans, in other parts of North Africa, already starting to not only have this global ideology and vision for the fight against the far enemy, the United States as he saw it, but also wanting to draw in recruits from all over the world. So he himself is Saudi, Ayman al-Zawahiri, his longtime deputy, Egyptian. They brought Muslims in from all over the Arab world, but also already thinking big.
And then the establishment of Al-Qaeda, the base, once the Taliban, his allies in Afghanistan, took control of the government there and offered him a place to operate.
That's right. Bin Laden does not have a good track record of lasting in countries that agree to host him, so he got kicked out of Sudan. And by 1996, he found himself back in Afghanistan. He didn't always have smooth relations with the Taliban. They asked him to lay low. He didn't always respect that, but he was a critical source of financing for the Taliban, and so they found a way to work together. It was in those years in the late 90s. Bin Laden was in Afghanistan in 96. He issued a fatwa that U.S. military personnel should be killed by 1998, a fatwa meaning a religious order, questions over whether he had the authority to do it, but he did it. By 1998, he was saying, all Muslims, it is your duty to kill Americans wherever you find them. And then, of course, by 98 came the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania, and the first successful attack that really got the attention of the United States, 224 people killed in those embassy bombings.
Later, the attack on the USS Cole and Aden, and then, well, then 9/11.
Then 9/11, but surely he would have continued his most significant attack.
We just have a minute left in this segment, Ted.
Okay, I just don't want you to forget the first attack on the World Trade Center.
Back in 1993, that was organized.
Back in 93.
Yes, that was organized in part by Al-Qaeda, but in part by operatives here in the United States. And they were tried in federal court and are still serving time there. And yes, that was the first attack on the United States in 1993, Mary.
Absolutely right. And lots of questions about what role bin Laden may or may not have played in that early Trade Center attack. But that pattern already emerging of providing inspiration, if not direct tools and means to accomplish an attack.
Stay with us, Mary Louise Kelly. Also, of course, Ted Koppel. We're going to find out what the death of Osama bin Laden will mean for Al-Qaeda and its various affiliates around the world. NPR's Mike Schuster will also join us. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. With us is NPR commentator Ted Koppel. Also with us is Mary Louise Kelly, who spent the last decade covering intelligence and national security for NPR, now teaches at Georgetown University. And also joining us is Mike Schuster, NPR diplomatic correspondent, who's with us from the studios at NPR West. And Mike Schuster, good of you to be with us today. And Mike, are you there? Mike's not there yet. We'll get him in just a moment. And Ted, one of the things we have to look at is what the death of Osama bin Laden means for Al-Qaeda. He was, yes, a symbolic figure, but yes, a decision maker as well. Yes, an inspirational figure and a fundraiser, but clearly the single most important individual in Al-Qaeda.
And I think, I don't want to minimize the importance of his death. It is extraordinarily important. But the fact of the matter is, I don't think it's going to change the ability of these various far-flung al-Qaeda operations from Yemen to places in Northeast Africa. I don't think it's going to do anything to prevent them from operating. The big question, I think, will be whether al-Qaeda has another 9/11 in it. I have always wondered why it is that they have not taken, the suicide bombing route in the United States, where someone wearing an explosive vest blows himself or herself up in a supermarket or a basketball arena. And I had been told that Osama bin Laden very much wanted the gigantic gesture against the United States, and of course achieved that on 9/11. The fact that he is gone, I don't think is going to make a whole lot of difference in terms of the operational ability of these fragmentary groups around the world.
Mike Schister is with us now from NPR West. And Mike, it's probably worth pointing out the last two attempts that we know of for attacks on American soil, the attempt to set off a car bomb in Times Square and an attempt to bring down an airliner over Detroit were launched not by Al-Qaeda Central, as we came to call it, but by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
Yes, out of Yemen, I gather. And there was also the attempt just a year ago to explode a bomb in Times Square, carried out unsuccessfully by Faisal Shahzad, who was a Pakistani and who had support from, as I understand it, the Pakistan Taliban. In fact, there's a pattern here, Neil, of these attempted bombings going back 18 months, and most of them have been unsuccessful. But had they been successful, had that bomb, that car bomb exploded in Times Square, or the underwear bomber succeeded in bringing down a plane on Christmas 2009, we'd be having a much different discussion. We would have had many discussions since then about the vulnerability of the United States and the ability of al-Qaeda dispersed to carry out bombings. Now, it's worth pointing out that just last Thursday, I believe, a bomb exploded in a cafe in Marrakesh in Morocco, killing 16 people, mostly European tourists. And the day later, on Friday, three would-be bombers, alleged bombers, were arrested in Germany, plotting some kind of attack on a bus. So if any of these had actually occurred, and the one in Morocco did occur, we'd be having a much, much different conversation. And as far as we know, these kind of attempts are likely to continue.
What can you tell us about what we know about what's left of, and we'll begin, since we're talking about the death of Osama bin Laden, with Al-Qaeda Central?
Well, Al-Qaeda Central doesn't seem to have been functioning for a long time. Obviously, no attacks on such a grand scale as 9/11 have occurred. And given the U.S. role in Afghanistan, it's clear that Al-Qaeda dispersed came up after some years with this approach of sending out individuals or small cells to carry out bombings. At the same time, the war in Iraq really dominated the planning of al-Qaeda and some in al-Qaeda Central. And al-Qaeda played a very large role in putting together the insurgency or playing a part in the insurgency in Iraq. And that still continues. There are still some quite spectacular acts of violence involving suicide bombers killing large numbers of people. And it's believed that al-Qaeda in Iraq or affiliates or like-minded cells have been carrying out those attacks. They continue.
Mary Louise?
I would just jump in and point out that one of the big question marks hanging over this conversation about whither al-Qaeda and how much of al-Qaeda is left now that its leader has been taken out is the question of what we've seen unfolding in the Middle East all spring. Big questions have been raised about, is this good news for al-Qaeda? Is this bad news? What bad news for al-Qaeda? What kind of role have they played in any? You know, we're talking about al-Qaeda in Yemen, the al-Qaeda branch in Yemen, and how the recent attempts to pull off a big attack are coming out of there. well, Yemen is a huge question mark. You know, is their longtime president about to slip away off into the sunset? What's going to be happening there? Will U.S. counterterrorism officials be able to operate with the same freedom that they have enjoyed in past? And what kind of controls is the U.S. going to be able to exert in a lot of these countries where, you know, al-Qaeda core members came from, where we worry about al-Qaeda branches shooting up and gaining more power? So it's one thing, obviously, to look at what's happening with core al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan. A lot of the action is happening in places that are very unsettled right now as we speak.
And Ted Koppel.
And Neil, yeah, just to square the circle, Neil, a lot of the al-Qaeda volunteers who operated in Iraq came out of, guess where, eastern Libya. The very area now where the rebels are fighting against, I mean, the fact of the matter is that Muammar Gaddafi may not be entirely crazy when he says that some of the people who were trying to get rid of him and overthrow the government were al-Qaeda. Some of them, in fact, were.
Just last week, reports that one of the Guantanamo detainees released to Libya is, in fact, a commander of a rebel unit in eastern Libya right now. But Ted Koppel, one of the keystones of the U.S. fight against terrorism throughout that part of the world has been its cooperation with the intelligence services of, well, among the most important countries, Egypt.
Egypt, and as Mary Louise was saying just a moment ago, Yemen. It is already becoming clear that the Egyptian foreign policy trend, that the political motion in Egypt these days is moving in a general direction that is less friendly toward the West, less friendly, friendly is probably the wrong word to use, but less inclined toward collaboration and coexistence with Israel, and the degree to which Egyptian intelligence will be the same huge asset that it was to the United States intelligence organizations, that really remains an open question.
But Mike Schuster, I wanted to bring you in here. There is another aspect of this, that bin Laden and al-Qaeda provided an opportunity, a way for the incredible number of young people in the Arab world to focus their frustrations, to give them a means to enact change. It now is evident there are other means available to them to enact change.
It certainly is obvious that there are other avenues to change, and that far more people are choosing the go out in the street, protest, demonstrate, make it known to the world which leaders have won the approval of young people, which leaders have won the disapproval of young people. It seems to me that this whole movement, this whole revolt that swept the Arab world and the Arab Middle East since January is a rebuke to al-Qaeda, is essentially saying, no, you're wrong. It wasn't necessary. It hasn't been necessary to mount jihad and violent attacks on governments in the Middle East in order to effect change. But what's also interesting is that as this thing has swept along, as Mubarak in Egypt gave up power and the Tunisian president gave up power, others, like the president of Yemen, have dug in their heels, as has Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And this revolt in these different countries, it's not clear how it's going to end. It certainly can be said that that al-Qaeda, as it continues to exist in Yemen at least, is going to benefit from the chaos there. The president of Yemen was a good friend of the United States in allowing the United States to pursue al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen. And I think in part that's one of the reasons why the United States has been uncertain about what policy to approach it needs in Yemen. And that could be the case now in Egypt as well, with Mubarak gone. Mubarak and the United States cooperated on cracking down on elements that were connected to al-Qaeda.
There's also the case of Somalia, Mike, and that is al-Shabaab, is said to be an associate of al-Qaeda as well. The United States has mounted attacks in Somalia as well.
Yeah, I think that the key here is chaos in different parts of the Middle East is good for al-Qaeda. Chaos is not good for the United States and not good for the people living in those societies. Those who are leading al-Qaeda or branches of al-Qaeda figured out a way of exploiting chaos.
Mary Louise Kelly, will this be seen as a vindication of U.S. policy, which, yes, there was enormous desire to get this done 10 years ago, but patient, grinding work finally resulted in, well, President Obama said last night, the first significant success in the war against terrorism.
Well, it is a significant success, but boy, has it been a long time coming. I mean, this was something where I think had you asked U.S. intelligence and military personnel, you know, back in 2001, would a decade from now, would it be a decade before they were able to take out bin Laden? Nobody would have believed it. Clearly it will be seen as a vindication, as a success. And interestingly, it followed the pattern that a lot of people thought it might. You know, bin Laden was so good at defensive security, stopping using telephones, didn't use email. You know, it worked against him in that it took months for his messages to get out, and it sometimes seemed as though he was very out of touch with current events. By the same token, he was awfully hard to track, and we are, you know, hearing a lot about this courier who they managed to try to track, and it took months and months and months to unravel and figure out. This one guy leads you to another guy, which leads you to another guy, which leads you to another guy. And finally, they're able to track him down. And this also follows the picture that that intelligence professionals had laid out. You know, for many years, they were searching for him in North Waziristan, South Waziristan, the tribal areas along the border with Afghanistan. And then increasingly in recent years, the thinking has been, well, maybe not. Maybe he has moved to a city. Would he want to hang out in a place with such constant U.S. drone surveillance, a place relatively close to all the U.S. and NATO troops massed on the Afghan side of the border? Maybe he's hiding in plain sight. Maybe he's in a city. The fact that he's emerged in a city so close to Islamabad, so close to the heart of Pakistan, I think has probably taken some Pakistanis by surprise, certainly many Americans here.
We're told that there was a large amount of intelligence material seized at the house in Abbottabad, where these operations took place early this morning, Pakistan time. And if previous patterns are followed, Mary Louise, it's going to be people looking out for changes in signals as the leadership structure of al-Qaeda now has to change. People who previously had been connected with the Sheikh, with Osama bin Laden, now need to find their orders elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the CIA has got people on the ground there now. They will be coming through, of course, everything they can find there, every laptop, every phone, any phone number that can widen that web, and trying to chart all of those communications. But there are a lot of really interesting immediate questions now about, we assume, Ayman al-Zawahiri will take over the mantle of al-Qaeda. He's known to be, or thought to be, a rather different thinker than bin Laden. He's trained as a physician. He was more of a strategic thinker. He has not been the big action planner guy. You know, that's been kind of the traditional number three post in al-Qaeda. And who will actually be giving orders, who's actually available to take those orders now, and how this will play out, all big questions.
But Ted Koppel, what we heard about Osama bin Laden and the genius of his organization, not simply very good security, which Mary Louise Kelly was just talking about, but that this was essentially a system of cells that were scattered and did not necessarily need direction from above.
And very, very difficult to fight against. I think one of the interesting points, Neil, is, we too are undergoing rather massive changes in this country. The president has completely reshuffled his security team, and General David Petraeus is coming in as the head of the CIA. I think it's extremely interesting to look at the makeup of the team that finally succeeded here. It was a team made up, we have been told, of both CIA operatives and special forces, that is, Navy SEALs. And one of the large questions that has been raised in recent days since General Petraeus's nomination has come up is what the role of the CIA is going to be globally from here on in. It was established back in the 1940s, of course, as an intelligence-gathering organization. More and more, it's becoming sort of a quasi-military operation that is capable, with small units and great surprise, operations and fantastic planning to pull off operations that seem to be beyond the capabilities of large-scale military units.
And Mike Schuster, as we look at the implications for various aspects, you've spent time in Iraq lately, and I know you always pay attention to what's going on in Iran. We had been told that parts of Osama bin Laden's family had fled to Iran, obviously not all of it. Some of it was there in Abbottabad this morning, Pakistan time. But what about Iran, and how does that play into this?
It's a really good question, and it's hard to know, Neil. Some years ago, we first learned of the story of some of the key bin Laden associates and even members of his family seeking refuge in Iran from Afghanistan. And somewhere along the line, I think the Iranian authorities acknowledged that that was the case. They claimed that the al-Qaeda refugees have been put in prison or were being held under house arrest. And then that story has gone largely dead for some time. And it's hard to say whether there's any kind of an update or not. There was a hint a few years ago that the Iranians might want to trade with the United States or deal with the United States with these figures, but nothing ever came of that. And it's something to return to, for sure, to probe to see what we really know or what those individual figures might do now that bin Laden himself has been removed from the scene.
And Ted Koppel, it's important to point out, as we've looked at the various kinds of attempts that have happened in this country, luckily, unless you count Fort Hood as an al-Qaeda-inspired effort, they have not been successful. But there is the prospect of self-motivated people in this country going on operations on their own.
And we have no idea, Neil, how many sleeper operatives there may be in this country. I just think it's always wise to take the position that as good a piece of news as this is, and as an important an event as it is, that the age of terrorism, I'm afraid, is very much alive and well and still with us, and we have to be prepared for terrorist attacks. I would just sort of direct you in one slightly new direction as we move into our second hour, and that is how much of a domestic impact this is going to have. If indeed President Obama continues to believe that getting out of Afghanistan in a relatively short period of time is still important, this may be just the political moment to put that into effect.
Among our guests in the next hour, retired General Colin Powell, the former Secretary of State, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But before we go in this hour, it's worth remembering what President Obama said last night after he announced that the United States had sent forces deep into Pakistan and killed Osama bin Laden.
The death of bin Laden marks the most significant achievement to date in our nation's effort to defeat al-Qaeda. Yet his death does not mark the end of our effort. There's no doubt that al-Qaeda will continue to pursue attacks against us. We must, and we will, remain vigilant at home and abroad.
Our thanks to NPR's Mike Schuster, diplomatic correspondent who joined us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California, and to Mary Louise Kelly, who spent much of the past decade covering these issues for NPR, now teaches at Georgetown University here in Washington. This is special coverage from NPR News.